Accession number 8974, rule number 2.
Mr. Cliff, reel 2. The question I was asking you was, what position in the convoy would the Chitral take up?
Oh, invariably in whatever convoy we were in, escorted, we'd nearly always be in the middle of the convoy.
For what reason?
Probably a decoy.
And did you have to take any special precautions against the cold for the Russian convoys?
Well, we were supplied with winter underclothing, like long johns, you know, nice woolly long johns. I think everybody on board grew a beard, which helped a lot. Kept the face warm and that. We had the hoods. I forget what they call them now.
Parkas?
My big parkas, yeah, similar to that. Hoods and well buttoned up with the toggle button on the front, yeah.
Oh, duffel coats?
Similar to a duffel coat, yes. And gloves, of course, which were supplied by the civilian population. You used to get cases and cases of woolens with people's addresses on, names and addresses. Often strike up a pen friend through this, say, a pair of gloves or socks. Always plenty of worries.
And were you attacked on the convoy by the Germans?
We had one or two experiences by aircraft, German aircraft.
Can you describe them?
We lost an oil tanker on one particular day, a direct hit, no doubt, from the German planes. Following day, I think we lost two. I know probably out of the 18 that started in the convoy, I think we finished up with about 9 or 10, maybe less than that, ships.
What was your action station on the Chitral?
I was one of the gun crews on the after gun. It's on the quarter deck.
So did you fire yourself during the convoy?
No, because it was mostly the AA 4.7s or 4-inch guns doing the shooting up in the air, because ours were more or less for the surface firing on the a floating target, not an air target.
When any of the ships got hit, did you stop to pick up survivors or not?
No, that was more or less the escort destroyers or the corvettes would do that. That was their job. Of course, they were near to the waterline for lowering a boat.
Did you have cargo aboard the Chitral?
No, we didn't carry cargo as such.
What kind of speed could you do?
Without the rivets parted, I suppose you could do 18, probably 18 knots, and that was it. But we was never flat out in a convoy. You'd always get a slow straggler, and invariably they're signalling in, you know, buck his ideas up more. But you always got one, no matter where, what part of the world you was in a convoy, there would be one straggler. Of course, most of them were coal-fired, as such in them days. You know. We was like, we'd been on oil, naturally, but most of the liners on oil, but you get a straggler that puffs the smoke, giving your position away, blowing all over the place.
Did you curse them?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't, but the captain used to. It didn't do us any good, but you've got to go back and perhaps escort him because he can't keep up. You might have to leave the convoy and go. If not us, maybe the corvette would. I think it mostly depended on what cargo these stragglers carried, whether it was food or arms, ammunition or whatever. Because if they weren't carrying anything very important, then they just used to leave them and make their own way, sort of thing, the best way they could. But if they was carrying something, then it was up to us to get them to their destination safely.
Were you attacked on a Russian convoy by German vessels?
No. No, there was no service radars as such. Mostly air.
Submarines?
No, never got a submarine scare.
When you got to Russia, which ports did you go to?
I think the first one was Murmansk.
Did you go ashore?
Yeah.
What was it like?
I'd say it was more hostile than friendly.
In what way?
Well, to start off with, we were given a pep talk. We kept in sixes. We weren't allowed to raise our arm or hand above a shoulder. And we kept in groups of six. We was escorted from the bottom of the gangway out to the dockyard by a woman. Woman come man. Very big. Very brawny. Small arms slung over her shoulder. Automatic rifle or pistol or whatever. And she'd be waiting for you when you come back. To escort you back to the ship.
Who gave you the pep talk?
Oh, a bit of captain.
What did he say?
We're going to pull in at Murmansk. ETA estimated time of arrival will be such and such a thing. Starboard watch will go ashore, or port watch, whichever one was due for shore leave. And I don't know whether he's letting the ship's name down. You'll go ashore in groups of six, no less. You'll not raise your hand above your shoulder. You'll not get involved in any brawls, fights, drunkenness. And, I think that was about it.
What did the captain mean about not raising your arms above your shoulder?
Well, probably signals of the, not signals, what do they call it? Fascist salute or whatever. That's what he was appertaining to, I think. He was referring to keep your arms down to your side.
So he meant that if somebody gave a fascist salute, it would be provocative?
Mm. Yes.
Had people been known to do that?
Not on our ship. What about any other ships?
Did anybody let the ship's name down, in fact?
No, we weren't there ashore long enough, really.
How long were you ashore?
We had 4 hours, and we came back, and then the other watch went ashore for 4 hours. It was just more or less to break the monotony.
What did Murmansk look like?
A very dismal place, but I saw a bit. You know, of course, mostly around. All dock areas are the same, no matter what part of the world you go to. You know, you've got drab buildings and low-class bars or cabarets or whatever. And we just went in the first bar we came across and had a little drink and washing and doing their dancing to the music of the balalaikas, I believe it's called, the instrument. But you couldn't see or do a lot in 4 hours, you know. Mostly drinking.
What did you drink?
I was on Russian stouts. And of course I had to sample the vodka. And my God, that's got a kick in it, that stuff.
Did people get drunk?
I wouldn't say drunk as such, no. A little merry.
Did you talk to any of the Russians?
I never, no. Nobody could speak Russian, you know. But no matter where you go in the world, you just give this sign that they know what you want, and you know they know you're in that place for that particular service of drink, so they bring you the drink There was no menu, you just pointed to a bottle, you know. That's about it.
Did any of the Russians attempt to converse with you by sign language?
Well, they tried, you know, exchange cigarettes, for instance. Well, I used to have tobacco, rolled tobacco. Then I got a piece of some tobacco from this other Russian, civilians they were, you know, probably fishermen or dockies or something. And, God, their tobacco's strong as their vodka is.
Do they seem friendly or not, the civilians?
Yes, I suppose I was amiable enough. Probably glad enough to see that the convoy had arrived, or part of the convoy had arrived safely, you know. Because at that time, they were very desperate, the Russians. Very desperate.
Was it covered in snow or not?
Not all snow, no, but there was ice here and there. That's why I was... I feel sure it wasn't their winter as such, the heavy winter, because it's just a little ice here and there. You see the snows up in the hills, obviously, where it's higher, but down around the docks, there's just ice, you know. So it could have been the latter end of their winter, I think.
Were they wooden buildings or stone buildings or what?
Well, there's some stone, some very old wooden ones in the docks, but ashore it was mostly brick buildings.
Did there seem to be any sign of bombing?
Yes, there was piles of rubble, come to think of it, here and there, and some was left of houses. Yeah, a fair amount, I'd say. A fair amount when we got there.
Were there any Russian warships in the harbour when you got there?
Not over the other side. I think there was a couple of cruisers, probably. Probably cruisers, destroyers, small craft. Yeah.
Did Russian warships meet the convoy?
They had two come out. But, of course, where we went was a different docks to where the convoy went, the merchant navy ships went, you know. We weren't in our dock and they went round into the merchant navy probably to unload or some type of thing like that, you see.
Did you go anywhere else besides Murmansk?
Vladivostok. We picked up one from Vladivostok.
Picked up on what?
Convoy, but that was very small. But we left it off Norway, and then we went back into Norway. That was when I first went into what we termed as Cripple Creek.
What was Cripple Creek?
That's that fjord I happened to mention on Reel 1, the fjord where the ships had been hit and was just lying there at anchor. It's a fjord that once you're in there, you've got to come out the same way as you went in, had a boom right across, and there was no other way out than the way you went in, as I say. You've got these two sort of mountain ranges coming down. And you just laid there at anchor, and being that the clouds were so low, you could hear the aircraft, but they were just bombing at random. You couldn't see them. They just dropping their bombs at random. Some have rolled down the hill, wouldn't explode even. Those that did hit were very, very lucky, because they couldn't pinpoint the ship. The clouds were so low. Had the aircraft come as low as the cloud, they'd have hit the mountain range. Well, a very, very high hills, not mountains. So they couldn't dive bomb. You just had to go cross backwards and forwards, dropping their bombs at random.
This was on the way back from the Russian convoy, was it?
Yes. We left the convoy. They carried on to UK. We went into Norway at that time. If I could only pinpoint the date, because it was round about that time that the Battle of Narvik was on. Was on, had been on, or was going to get on. When, I think it was the 8th boats went into Narvik, they had the Battle of Narvik, didn't they? I think all destroyers, there was a, I think, best part of a flotilla of destroyers knocked hell out of it, out of Narvik there.
But that didn't concern you personally?
No, we was, no.
I think that at one stage in the war you were on the Fife's banana boat. What was it called?
It was called the armed merchant cruiser, armed merchant ship Patia, P-A-T-I-A, or Pashia, as some used to call it.
And where was it docked?
On the Tyne, on the River Tyne, Newcastle, South Shields.
And I think that you said nothing worked aboard.
There was nothing functioning, no. What was happening? We was going on board every day and going back to our lodgings. They found us lodgings up there. And every day it was a routine report back to the ship. Little painting, tidying up. But at the same time, there was pipes from the dockyard, mateys working on it, riveters, welders, all the paraphernalia you get in the dockyard, working on board. Until such times, I suppose I was on up there a month on this lodging comp, going back with a force to the ship.
What does lodging comp mean?
We were lodging ashore, but going back on board working, because there was no fit accommodation on the ship. So you stayed in lodgings, and the Navy paid your host or hostess or whatever, they paid them to keep.
What does comp mean? Oh, it's alright if you don't know. What were your duties on board ship, personally?
I was quartermaster, and that meant, of course, in the wheelhouse, and doing the duty on the gangway, keeping your eyes open for officers coming on board or leaving the ship, keeping the deck, the log up to date, the deck log, taking temperatures, all the paraphernalia that a normal quartermaster does, you know, on a man of war, proper man of war.
Why did you have to keep your eye on for officers?
Well, you didn't know who the officer would be. He could be a commander of the dockyard, or he could from the shore base, which I believe was called HMS Calliope, the shore base there.
And what was it on board ship that didn't work?
Oh, everything malfunctioned. We had a lovely catapult. Of course, no aircraft actually in the docks, but it didn't function. Radar, that didn't function. Degaussing gear, no do, didn't go. And the anti-magnetic screen around the ship, that didn't function at all. And the object, I suppose, was to get the ship ready for sea and go to Belfast to get all the gear functioning as it should do. But unfortunately, we never reached it.
So you set sail for Belfast, did you?
Pardon?
You set sail for Belfast?
Yes, we sailed for Belfast. And I suppose we steamed 3 or 4 hours. Next thing, I'm in the water, and we're off the little village, lifeboat village of Almouth. And that was very interesting, because when we went into Almouth, the villagers told us it looked like a bonfire night. They could see all the firework display at sea, plus the explosion.
What time of the day was the ship attacked?
I think it was about 9 o'clock at night, and we sailed at half six-ish.
Can you describe how what happened when the ship was attacked? You described
Yes, the plane came over, probably weighing us up, the same as we were weighing him up. And we was at accident stations then, once the alarm had gone. I went to my duty post, which was in the wheelhouse at that time. And it came over from stern, right over the top of the ship, and dropped his one bomb. And it went right through the poop deck. Now, whether it was port side or starboard side, I cannot say. But the ship listed very heavily a few moments after impact. And I was blown up in the air and hit my head on the bulkhead.
And what do you remember after that?
I remember jumping in the sea, which was bloody cold, and swam round onto one of the boats, scrambled over the side of one of the boats, and we was picking them out of the water, mostly stokers with their hair alight and skin burnt. I don't know what degree of burns they suffered, but they certainly suffered some burns, those that were fortunate enough to get out.
And how long did it take you to get ashore?
Well, we could see the shoreline. It was very dark, mind you, but you could see the outline of the dark black shore against the night, well, I wouldn't say night sky, but against the lighter colour of the sky. And as you got closer to the shore, so most of the chaps in the boat started panicking, because we could see barbed wire, and we was afraid of the foreshore being mined. That's what we was afraid of. But there was a chap on along the beach guiding us with his torch and shouting to us where we could land. And by the time he'd found a place for us, mind you, we're pulling with the oars at the time, and we was about 50 yards out. We couldn't see him at this particular time. We could see the torch, and we could hear him shouting. And he told us to pull further along. And by the time we did find a place, the dawn was breaking at the time, and we could see the barbed wire then. And he pulled the barbed wire to one side, and we just beached the boat. And those that could, that was mobile, got out and lifted those serious cases that was really wounded bad, lifted them. And by this time, more villagers had come down with stretchers and helped us get them all up into the little village pub, which they opened up, and there was rum handed round. There was a pile of trousers in one corner, a pile of jackets in another corner, shoes and socks, etc., etc. And I finished up with a pair of trousers. Must have been for a 6-foot man. I had to roll the bottoms up, same as the jacket. But we got anything on once we was, because it was so cold. It was only a few hours in the boat, but it was very cold. And the buzz went round that they picked up the crew of this aircraft. Of course, we'd done no more, us that was mobile, done no more than grab bits of wood, anything we could belt hell with, and we trooped down to the foreshore. But there was nobody in the lifeboat other than the skipper, who had died with his paper, his documents, under his arm. Of course, rigor mortis had set in, no doubt. And, of course, we dropped the sticks and took our caps off and went up to, I think they laid him into the lifeboat place where they launched the lifeboat from. I think they put him in there, the skipper. and a few other bodies were picked up as well. I think about a dozen. So in all, I think out of a crew of 200 odd crew, I think there's about 60 of us survived.
Were you injured yourself?
I wasn't injured as such, but the pilot of the aircraft, who I became very friendly with on the short time I knew him, was in my mess. We lost him. He went down below. Somebody saw him going down below for his money or something, some valuables. Didn't see him anymore.
The pilot of what?
The pilot. The pilot of the aircraft that we should have had, or we was going to get. He went down below. He was seen no more.
What aircraft was this?
Well, I think it would have been the... got for there or on the catapults at that time. Can't actually recall what the aircraft would have been had we picked one up.
You talked about the people who were injured. What kind of injuries did they have?
There was probably shrapnel burns more than anything. Those that survived the stokehole, well, it was burns.
What type of aircraft attacked you?
I believe it's a Dornier.
And?
A Dornier? Or a Focker Wulf? Now, I'm not too sure. Dornier or Focker Wulf?
Did you fire back at it?
We fired our rockets and hit it. It came down.
Can you describe these rockets that you had?
Well, they were long, elongated, slim fellows. I suppose they were about 5 foot long. Now, 6 inches or 7 inches in diameter, with long fins at the back, four long fins, and it just shot off, hoping to hit the target probably.
And you said the head was magnetised?
We believe that the head was magnetised, yes.
What date would it have been? What time of year?
It was April, definitely April, because while I was in the wheelhouse on leaving the time, Churchill was giving one of his big speeches. That's why it stands so much in my memory. It's so clear, that evening of the speech.